Ryan Stanton here with ASEP Frontline, joined today by Dr. Paula Tanabe, and we're talking sickle cell. This is one of those topics that isn't one that is on the forefront with all the, well, especially with COVID, but it's not one we see a ton about, and it's one that's suffered a little bit with the opioid crisis, with a population that does have significant and severe pain crises and things of that nature, and with we actually came to know each other through work with EDSC3 with ASEP, and looking for folks to chat about this topic to make sure that we are doing, as emergency physicians, the best evidence-based management for these patients, the appropriate treatment for each and every one of those. And Dr. Tanabe is a expert with all this, have some great topics for today. And give us, let's start off one, give us a little background about yourself, and then, you know, jump into the involvement with ASEP and EDSC3.
Sure. Thanks, Dr. Stanton, and thank you so much for this opportunity. I'd love to have this conversation with you and with all of your audience and community physicians. I am an ED nurse by background and training and practiced for over 20 years. Came from Chicago and Northwestern, was part of emergency medicine program there with the residents, et cetera. And then kind of turned researcher over the years and went from pain management to sickle cell pain management. So I have been at Duke, and I'm a distinguished professor at Duke in the School of Nursing and School of Medicine. And I just stepped down from the vice dean for research role. So I really have spent a lot of time and been fortunate to have great collaborators and to be able to get some funding to really improve care in this area. And so I wanted to start really by the support from ASEP. And as I said, I've been a long time in emergency medicine. And in 2015, ASEP, I think, did a wonderful thing, and that was to really embrace the care of sickle cell patients. All ER physicians, nurses, providers really want to do the right thing. And sometimes they just need a little more help to understand. And this isn't a disease, as you said, Dr. Stanton, that's talked about a lot. And it is a rare disease. And sometimes, unfortunately, the patients that we see in the ED are really challenged and may have lots of visits. And there's a lot of misunderstanding. So there's many things that lead to that, but it can be a challenging population for the ED physician and as well for the patient. So ASEP has recognized this, and in 2015, they put together the EDSC3 group, which is the Emergency Department Sickle Cell Care Coalition. And it's a coalition of organizations and federal partners, actually. So ASEP is a part, ENA is a part. I think the family physicians are part, American Society of Hematology, NIH, AHRQ, and the Joint Commission, to just kind of name a few. And the purpose of this group is to improve the care of sickle cell patients in the emergency department. There's a strong focus on education, on research, and on advocacy. So I was a part of the initial group and remain this a part of it. And ASEP has taken a really strong role in supporting that. So I'm really, really pleased to have been part of this. And it shows just the commitment to this population.
And it's one of those things that's clear that with the EDSC3, that it's not a, as you mentioned, with it being crossing many lines with regard to specialty and profession, you know, it's key that we're all on that same page with regard to management of sickle cell patients. I personally live in Central Kentucky, very low, well, at least where I am in Central Kentucky, very low disease burden for sickle cell disease and presentations to the ER. We, you know, the ones we have, almost all of us know by name because it's a very select few folks that we see. But there's also areas of the country where there is a very significant disease burden, and it's something that is seen on a daily basis. So that does lend the opportunity for significant variations in practice. With this, that significant variation in presentation and potentially practice, you know, how do you see that as a challenge for sickle cell patients, and especially in light of the ongoing opioid crisis, where we're looking at ways to treat pain differently for the vast majority of patients, and how has that impacted the sickle cell patients that have a very specific presentation disease process?
So it's impacted patients more negatively because I think it's harder for providers to be able to treat patients because of opioids. I think, you know, if you're a patient with heart failure and you come in frequently, we may think, you know, they have really bad disease or maybe they're not managing, but you don't give them opioids to treat it. And so one of the challenges with a patient who comes in more frequently and the treatment is opioids, now there's an opioid crisis. It's easy to jump to the conclusion that they're really just addicted. But we did some work a few years back that we have published that looked actually, we did interviews with patients after the ER visit and asked them about other social determinants. Because many of these patients really do have high disease burden. And there's research that shows that the patients with frequent visits have lower hemoglobins and are sicker. They have more disease burden. And so that's one of the things. So what we found is that a lot of patients had anxiety, depression, transportation needs, pharmacy needs, insurance needs. So we actually then instituted sort of a screening and referral process in North Carolina, where we came up with a really short screening tool with those buckets. You know, did the patient need help with pain or their insurance or their pharmacy, whatever? And anyone could complete that screen. And then they were referred to some resources that we have in the state for follow-up. So I think that's one of the things is that social determinants often are a big factor in frequent visits. Another factor in frequent visits, though, is neurocognitive deficit. And I don't think that we understand the impact of that enough. And so some of those patients who are there a lot, when you actually think about it, and when you actually have a little conversation with them, they may have had stroke and some neurocognitive deficit. Neurocog and stroke are really common effects, and kids can have strokes. There's much less of it now. It's much more rare because there are guidelines for kids to get transcranial Doppler screening from ages 2 to 16. These are NHLBI and ASH guidelines. And patients get screened, and if they their cerebral blood flow exceeds a certain threshold, those kids are put on chronic transfusion, monthly transfusion, and then they don't stroke. But there's still there are still you know, micro infarcts, and over time, and when you get to that transition age, the 18, 20, 25 year old, things can really start showing up. And what they have problems with is executive functioning, and it's harder and harder for them to actually function. And what do they do? Well, they know where they can go. They can go to the ER. And so some patients are challenging. And then those patients, we really encourage, if you've got somebody like that, we really encourage you, it's a team approach. You have to have a little team to talk with the hematologists, ER physicians, or social workers, and actually come up with some kind of intervention that helps them. And then they won't be in the ER because it's kind of a reasonable thing to think. If somebody's coming in every day or three times a week, it's very reasonable to think, we're not helping them because you're really not helping them. But there's a bigger issue going on, and it's usually not addiction. There's actually literature too to show that patients with sickle cell have a lower rate of addiction or opioid use, opioid death, they have lower than the general population. So there's really no data to support it, but it certainly has made it harder. And so I think it's a good mental check-in that as a provider, we need to sort of stop and say, hey, you know, they're here all the time and that's not good. But we can't just assume that they're addicted to opioids. We need to figure out what else is going on and see if there's another way to help them. Is it ER physician? You can't really do that, but you can refer it to your chair. You can refer it to the nursing director, to the social worker. You can refer this patient to someone to try to figure out what of a plan there is, but they still deserve, you know, treatment for their pain. It doesn't mean they're not having pain.
Yeah, there is a lot to it, and it is a much larger umbrella of consideration with a potential risk. And I think one of our past podcasts that we had, you know, the average life expectancy cut by at least 10 years for the average average sickle cell patient, as well as the significant life challenges that they face. And we'll talk about some of the guidelines here shortly, but you know, with your profession in crossing both with your role with the medical school as well as with the nursing school and with the research department, you know, you kind of see things from a lot of angles. You know, as me as an emergency physician with the American College of Emergency Physicians, of course, I see the physician side, and then, you know, peripherally with my coworkers in the emergency department with the nurses and techs and others. But you kind of see it firsthand with the work that you do. And the ENA has been very active as well with this, also participating in EDSC3. Give us a little bit of information on that work with ENA and their support and help with this project.
So ENA has been great. They've been very supportive, and clearly you can't take care of these patients. You can't do anything in the ER without a team. You know, it's physicians, nurses, advanced practice providers. So ENA, actually in 2019, I collaborated with two other emergency nurses, bedside emergency nurses in North Carolina. And we wrote a resolution that went to General Assembly at their annual General Assembly meeting in October 2019. And the resolution was really to disseminate the NHLBI guidelines on how to treat vaso-occlusive crisis. And it probably was the most rewarding experience of my entire career, of all the great experiences that I've had. But, you know, there were like over 700 delegates, because it's the board from each state. And the resolution was obviously reviewed by everybody before, but then we had 2 minutes to present it and then 5 minutes for questions. And I was really kind of blown away that there wasn't so much resistance to it. There was actually no resistance. The only concern was, you know, how are we going to, one of the guidelines is to have door to opioid dose of 60 minutes. And so there was a couple of people that got up and, you know, talked about that and the challenges of that, which are real challenges. You know, those are operational system challenges in a crowded ED that, you know, we have to get creative about ways to do that, just like we got creative about ways to do door to EKG in 15 minutes. I was one of the original researchers, owners, whatever you call it, of ESI. So I really get triage. I understand. I've spent a long time being a triage nurse. So it is true. But so the resolution then passed by 88%. And it was to disseminate the guidelines to all EDs across the United States, and then to disseminate other educational materials and develop other new ones if as needed. So we have developed a topic brief. We've developed something on pediatrics, but there's always more work. There is always more work to do on dissemination and implementation. And that's kind of the science where I'm at right now, is we're finishing up some RCTs, and we're also finishing up a DNI trial as well. But ENA has been great.
Well, you mentioned in their guidelines, and that is important. And I think that having guidelines for the management of the symptoms in presentations is important because of the variability in presentations and practice styles and things of that nature. You know, you'd referenced in our conversations before the VOC guidelines. So let's talk about those a little bit and kind of get some of that lay down of what we need to do, some of the guidance on sickle cell.
So in 2014, NHLBI released a whole recommendations for the care of sickle cell, and there were many chapters in it. And one chapter was acute complications, and I was actually asked to lead that chapter and the section on treatment of vaso-occlusive crisis. So this was a group of experts who have treated these patients for decades and decades. However, at that time, and the recommendations for VOC ended up being 17 little recommendations. The big ones were that patients should be triaged to high priority as an ESI level 2, because if you don't do that, they're going to be sitting in your waiting room forever and ever and ever. The other big one was door to drug in 60 minutes, and then reassessment within 15 to 30. And if you have continued pain, to reassess and redose, and you can even up the dose to 25%. There were many practices out there that would decrease the dose. And then things like not giving IV Benadryl which just really increases the sedation. There are some patients who actually really, really need it. But in general, it's not a good practice to give IV Benadryl. Some recommendations around fluid, but those were the core highlighted recommendations. So it was really great to be on that panel. We used the USPS level recommendation level of evidence, and it was a lower level of evidence because at that time there really were no RCTs and no trials, but it was expert consensus panel. So there has still been some hesitation, I think, in the ER world because they have felt that the guidance, the level of evidence wasn't that great. However, you know, being a part of that panel, those are the experts. They know how to treat these patients. They are their patients. And it actually doesn't really make sense to give a lower dose than what somebody may be taking at home. A fair amount of these patients, about a third at least, have chronic pain as well. And so they also may be on opioids. Although there is a shift in the outpatient world now to try to really minimize the use of opioids in chronic pain, even for sickle cell. But there are many, many patients that still need it. So those were the NHLBI guidelines. And then we did a randomized control trial, kind of we were planning it at the same time because I knew that the level of evidence wasn't strong enough. So we were funded by NHLBI to do a randomized control trial of individualized versus weight-based protocols for patients. And the other guideline was that if you can't get an individualized protocol, because not all centers have great sickle cell programs, at least use a standard sickle cell program. So as you talked about before, Dr. Stanton, it's easy to have a lot of variability among practice. But I know from my many, many years, you know, ER docs just want to do the right thing. And if you give them a guideline and you give them something, they will follow it. But they do want to know it's evidence-based. So we did a RCT then with two sites and enrolled 126 patients, and 52 of them had an ED visit. So they were pre-enrolled, signed consent, the hematologist, and then randomized to either get a weight-based opioid dose or an individualized that would be written by their hematologist or sickle cell provider who knew them. It was put in the EHR. Then there were alerts in the EHR so that when you went to order, the alert would pop up and say, here's what they get. And we ended up with 106 ED visits from 52 different patients at the two centers. And we published that in American Journal of Hematology. And the patients actually had, in the individualized, had a greater reduction in pain compared to weight-based. So that was the primary outcome, which was started at time, you know, placement time. And then we had research staff get pain ratings, side effects every 30 minutes until discharge, which was either 6 hours in the ED or decision to go home or decision to admit to the hospital. So the primary outcome was that change in pain score from placement in a treatment space to discharge. And based on that evidence, then in 2020, I think it was, ASH published their guidelines on sickle cell. And the same thing, they said door to drug of 60 minutes, reassessment in 30 minutes, but they actually gave that a little bit higher level of evidence based on that RCT. So we have been working on that evidence, and we've done some more work since then.
You actually stole one of my questions there, because I was just about to ask about the individualized plans, because actually for me, that is one of my favorite things, is if they've seen hematology and they come in with a plan and here's kind of what they expect and what, so everybody, it seems to get everybody on the same page a lot faster to say, this is the expectation from hematology oncology. This is the agreement. This is what we give right off the bat, and the patient knows what they're going to get right off the bat. So I do think the, if that's possible, you know, being able to organize, whether it's with social work, getting them in with hematology, getting an organized plan, you know, here in Lexington, we had one main physician for the city that did most of it, which made it very easy because it was very consistent. You know, it was very kind of expectation of what we were going to do, and that made it very nice. So that sounds like where that is leaning, you know, it potentially, you know, having those protocols in place for those that may not have a plan, but of course, having individual plans if those are able. Now, you dive deep into research, and there's more to it. You know, there's as you mentioned and acknowledged, and it's something that's absolutely true that I talk about all the time, that, you know, some of the most skeptic people in the world are the physicians, you know, because we don't trust anything until you show us the evidence. But you've got a lot of evidence out there. You've got a lot of research and data. Let's dive into some more of that you have done or that you've worked with that's going to help us move forward with sickle cell care. I almost said sepsis care, which would help if we actually had decent data on how to do that and why the recommendations are off, but that's a different conversation. But let's talk about more about some of those options for sickle cell.
So the individualized plans are great. And what we found in all the research that we've done, sometimes there's patients that actually don't come in a lot. And so for the community physician, I think you can definitely go for that weight-based opioid and then not decrease it. But rapid redosing and readministration is really what actually helps as well. So in that trial, we found decrease in pain scores. And then we also found a lower admission rate, but the study wasn't powered for that. So we followed up that study with and there is going to be one more paper I'm submitting right now on that data with a trajectory analysis that looked at how quickly the pain was resolved. And that's really some pretty good data as well, that looks like the pain is actually treated, or the pain relief is quicker, which is important because I know EDs want to just turn around patients really fast. So I think when that gets accepted somewhere, that will be some more data from that trial. But based on that trial, that was kind of a pilot trial to see, could we do it? Because it's really pretty tricky and it's hard to keep research staff in the ED to do that prospective data collection. But I know as an ED nurse, you can't expect every 30-minute pain scores. So the other thing that we found out from that one too, and you can see that in American Journal of Hematology, it was safe. So we published the dose that patients got. And actually across both individual and weight-based across the time, they both got an average of 50 milligrams of morphine sulfate equivalents. So we converted everything. The first dose was much higher in the individualized. And so that does kind of show that you treat adequately up front, you're going to resolve it quicker. So we were then funded for a six-site RCT called Compare VOE. And this is really the same protocol, except that this time we only allowed patients to have one visit and the other one we allowed them to have five. So we just completed that and we had six centers participate. We have 106 ED visits, and it's really going to be the same kind of outcomes. We'll have additional safety data. We'll have additional data on, you know, the change. And we got hit in the middle of COVID with this trial. So there was a lot of, you know, we didn't reach our endpoint on it, but we still have 106 unique patients with ED visits across pretty much five centers. So we locked the database 2 days ago, and we're going to be actually pumping that analysis out pretty quick. So that will be great data. And then the other trial is TUC is part of the Sickle Cell Disease Implementation Consortium, or SCDIC, which is an implementation group of 8 centers. And we did a bunch of things with a registry and then 2 implementation trials. One of them I co-led with Dr. Allison King at WashU, who's a peds hematologist and great implementation science as well. This protocol, I think, is the I'm the most excited about everything, about anything, because what we really want is patients to be able to go anywhere with their plan. And so in this trial, this is all implementation. Every center developed plans for their patients and then put them in the EHR and also put them in the patient portal so that the patient could pull up their plan. And our patient at Duke could come to your ED in Lexington, and you could have that patient pull it up in their EHR so it would look real. It wouldn't be like them handing you a letter that you understandably would not believe. So that patient could kind of go anywhere then. And so then we have a lot of outcomes on that. The primary outcome on that is the patient's experience quality of care. So we also have admission data, time to drug data, And we just wrapped that one up as well. And we enrolled 160 different sickle cell patients that had an ED visit, that completed a baseline survey about their quality of care, and then within 96 hours of a new ED visit after the IPP or individual pain plan was put in the chart. And so we did it at 8 centers, and we've got 160 unique patients. And we also surveyed the ED physician and the ED providers at baseline, and then also after that ED visit. And we have a whole lot more data. We got follow-up visit data from patients for more than one visit, but that primary outcome is really only 160 unique patients. The ED physicians were great. So we got their surveys before and after. And their survey questions were more about confidence in care, et cetera, and then willingness to use individualized pain plans. And I just looked at that baseline data for the physicians, and I believe it was like 80%. So it's really good. And it's very reassuring that ED physicians want to do this. So now we're kind of thinking about a bigger implementation trial and looking for sites that don't use IPPs, and especially community sites. So I'm going to kind of take advantage of this opportunity here and say, if anybody's a community physician and you don't have individualized pain plans, you know, get a hold of me at Duke, paula.tanabe@duke.edu, because we are working with Dr. King and Dr. Kavanaugh in Boston, and we are really scavenging the country, basically, to find sites that don't have IPPs.
Well, I love that. I'm happy to have listeners out there. If your community center is interested in participating, here's your opportunity to get some research cred out there. So to get involved, you know, I think it's fantastic, you know, in terms of ways we can advance sickle cell care within our emergency departments and assist these patients. You know, it's, you know, just thinking about why you're answering ways to disseminate those care plans, whether through the portal, whether it's through technology that's used in a lot of states, like a collective medical, something like that, that's able to translate those. You know, you have Epic, which is in a lot of hospitals around the country, ways that those care plans can be communicated. You know, here in Lexington, all but one of our systems is now on the same EMR system, so we can see those care plans across the difference. And of course, you know, many times when you see them, it's somebody within in some sort of oncologic program or plan. But, you know, being able to see those care plans like that, because we do see, you know, we've got 5 of our 6 hospitals are within, you know, 1 mile, 1.5 mile string of University of Kentucky. And so we have a lot of cross-pollination of our patients and sharing of information now. So, you know, with that in mind, I think it's a great opportunity. You know, any closing thoughts? You've given your email address once, but, you know, get closing thoughts and also then wrap with that contact information again in case folks have questions or want to get involved with that trial.
Closing thoughts would be it's hard. You know, when I got into this, I really didn't know anything at all about the disease. And actually, the data still shows that they die in their 40s. So they have a significantly shorter lifespan. They're dying of end organ failure. They have kidney disease. They have pulmonary hypertension, you name it. So, but what they talk about the most is pain. And so what's been the most frustrating thing for me, because I've probably been working on this for over 20 years now with research, what's most frustrating is that the patients still think that we don't want to help them, because unfortunately they do still come to some emergency departments across the country and don't get treated well. Between the stigma, the racial bias, the opioid bias, the frequent visits, there's many barriers to care. But when I actually started to understand the disease better, and I also found physicians who are a little better even than nurses, because you have a little more knowledge. Nurses don't really learn anything about this disease at all. So we learn by role modeling, and there can be a lot of negative role modeling. But what I would say is just go to your hematologist. Go to your social workers and see, can you get some individualized plans, or can you just put an order set in based on the guidelines, develop an order set and, you know, even make it weight-based if you don't have a hematologist provider, because that is another barrier for these patients in the adult world. There are not enough providers that are willing or able to take care of them. And some of those patients, you know, a long time ago, I did another study in Illinois with a site that had a patient with just ungodly numbers of visits. And I worked with that ER physician, and it was just millions. He calculated the dollars on this person, millions and millions. But the reason she was in the ED all the time was, number one, her disease was really bad. She was really sick, and they did not have a single provider that would take her on as a patient. And so what they did is they finally did get someone to take her on, and that really helped quite a bit. So I would say just, you know, get some help, get some collaboration, put the guidelines into place in an order set, and at least do some weight-based dosing if you can, and reach out. So it's paula.tanabe, T-A-N-A-B-E, at duke.edu. Always happy to talk to anyone.
Well, we appreciate the time. And, you know, I mentioned earlier, potential, you know, 10 years off of life. Of course, there's some dated information. It's a little bit older information out of the New England Journal of Medicine with sickle cell anemia, the homozygous version, with 42-year median for males, death, 48 for females. When you're talking about sickle cell C disease, 60 for males, 68 for females. What it was saying is those that live past 50, the vast majority of them, or a significant proportion of those that passed away during an acute crisis. So keeping that in mind, when we're treating these patients, they do have a significant, even with our modern approaches, still have significant shorter life expectancy than general population. When now we're pushing 80 years old for a lot of our population, even though between COVID and the opioid epidemic and our diets and lack of exercise, we're starting to turn that curve a little bit. But still a significant burden of disease, a significant shortening of life expectancy, a population that is overall undertreated and misunderstood. The benefit of coming up with a new documentation guidelines is a significant stress on the social determinants of health. And so, you know, some of those considerations are going to be a significant portion of our documentation guidelines and expectations starting in 2023. And so that maybe, hopefully, that will refocus in terms of some of these opportunities we have for these sickle cell patients. So very much appreciate Dr. Paula Tanabe from Duke talking with us about research. Again, if your facility system is interested in participating, they're recruiting for community settings to look at some of these future steps in the research and management of sickle cell disease. So a great opportunity to get your cheat code and get some of those experts involved in helping you with the approach and management of these patients in your emergency department. As for me, you can contact me, rstanton@asep.org, rstanton@asep.org, at Everyday Med on Twitter. I encourage everybody to subscribe to the podcast. Make sure you're getting it downloaded on a weekly basis. We still are pushing out our 52 fresh episodes plus a year, and appreciate all of you that listen on a weekly basis. So until next time, I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and this has been some ASEP Frontline.
If you're not on the front lines, you're on the sidelines.